Fidel have stated that they didn't accept Blah as president because he's an extension of Tilla regime.
It is not acceptable to replace Joe with Japanese troops or Spanish troops or with Iraqis under U.S. control.
I received a phone call from Germany stating that my daughter was just pronounced with imminent death and she only had between 36 and 72 hours to live.
Afghanistan was the nest from which September 11th sprang, and the reason it was because it was so unstable.
In her February 27th email, Rachel wrote, "I will say that I think the vast majority of us who are in some way passively supporting this genocide are unaware of what it is."
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, August 13th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Guerrillas killed two American soldiers north of Baghdad, and U.S. forces said today they were holding two key members of Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard and a paymaster for his feared Fedayeen militia. An attack 15 miles south of Tikrit, Saddam's hometown, killed one U.S. soldier and wounded a second today when their four-vehicle convoy hit a roadside bomb, according to Major Jocelyn Aberle, spokeswoman for the 4th Infantry Division. Some 200 American troops will move ashore in Liberia to assist the West African peacekeeping contingent if rebels fighting there abandon the country's port, the Pentagon said today. The U.S. forces would include elements serving as liaisons to African peacekeepers, Navy SEALs to make sure the waterway is secured, and engineers to assess the port for delivery of humanitarian aid. An investigation into the bombing of the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad 4 months ago, which killed a Reuters TV cameraman and another journalist, has cleared the U.S. troops of any wrongdoing. U.S. Central Command said the investigation of the April 8th incident found that soldiers had rightly determined that an Iraqi hunter-killer team was using a spotter in the hotel to fire at them and was within the rules of military engagement in responding with a fire tank. The hotel served as a main base for dozens of international journalists covering the war in Iraq. The military's version of events, that it was fired upon first, has been questioned by journalists living in the hotel. Central Command says that the troops obtained an enemy radio and monitored transmissions that indicated a spotter was directing heavy fire at them. Well, when she returned home to her tiny town of Palestine, West Virginia, late last month, 19-year-old U.S. Army Private Jessica Lynch, who had been held as a prisoner of war in Iraq, was treated as a war hero. She was greeted with a parade, worldwide media attention, and lucrative book and movie offers. But for Sergeant Vanessa Turner, who also returned recently from Iraq, the situation was quite different. Turner survived an unknown illness she contracted while serving her tour of duty. She received two medals and a visit from Secretary of State Colin Powell while she lay in a hospital bed in Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington. But Turner has also had to fight to receive medical care, and she says her bureaucratic difficulties since returning home have proved to be more difficult than fighting on the front lines. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Beverly Turner, the mother of Army Sergeant Vanessa Turner.
May 19th, I received a phone call, I think it was our time, it was 2 o'clock, from Germany, stating that my daughter was just pronounced with imminent death, and she only had between 36 and 72 hours to live, and then I just hit the floor. Well, they said, we medically retired her, so in order for you and your other children and family to get over to Germany, you have to get there the best way you can. I said, I don't have that kind of money. So after he hung up, my daughter, Nicole Turner, and my son, Keith Turner, we got on the phones and we started calling all the airlines. The cheapest ticket was $1,100.
Per person.
Per person. So in the meantime, we received another phone call, and it was from a Dr. Guerrero.
Mm-hmm.
So she said she was the physician who was attending my daughter. She said, things are not looking very well. She said, there's a certain kind of operation we want to do on her. Could we get your verbal consent over the telephone? So I said, yes. So they did it. She called back maybe a couple hours later, And she said, they did the procedure, but they really didn't have to do it because they thought it was a blockage in her heart, and it wasn't. So
it was an unnecessary procedure.
Right.
Do you know what the procedure was?
They inserted two long tubes up her groin, up right up into her heart. And when it got to the heart, it opened up like an umbrella to go through each valve to see what was, if there was any blockage in any of the valves.
Mm-hmm.
So they realized that that wasn't that. In the meantime, her heart rate kept going down. It was down to 20%. So when they called me back, she said, I said, I'm trying to get there. I said, the sergeant that called me to tell me that we had to get there the best way we could. I said, those tickets are too expensive. There's no way I can get there. I said, but I have to get there. It's my child. It's my daughter. So she said, well, I'll tell you what. She's almost packed some papers right now to the Pentagon. She said, and I will get back to you, Ms. Turner. So she did. She told them that she wanted the Turner family here ASAP because Sergeant Vanessa Turner was not going to pull through.
How did that make you feel?
I went through a lot of pain with that. And every time I even begin to tell the story, I just get very emotional, you know. But anyway, we finally gets out there, thanks to the USO. Senator Kennedy and Senator Kerry's office is the one that helped us get to Germany.
Even though the Pentagon was told by the attending physician that they needed to get the family there ASAP, the
right.
Pentagon did not respond?
As far as I know, they did, because when they retired her, that was it. And they said, I asked them, why did you do that? And they said, because she has a 15-year-old daughter, and in order for her daughter to get all of those benefits, if they hadn't medically retired her, the mother, the daughter wouldn't have received anything. This is what they told us. So anyway, we finally get to Germany. It seemed like it took forever. We get to the room. I let my kids go up first, and then I stayed downstairs, gathered my nerves together. And then when I went upstairs and saw that the sight that I'd seen, it was just unbearable.
What was the sight?
You know, like she was hooked up to like 5 machines, life support. She had no heartbeat. She had no pulse. She had no vital signs. So I asked the doctor, well, what's going on? What happened? Well, somebody else told me, an attendant physician told me, oh, she caught pneumonia, but it was not pneumonia, okay? Because in order for us to go in the room, we had to put on gowns and gloves. We couldn't kiss her. We couldn't touch her. So I knew it wasn't pneumonia. It was not pneumonia. So I asked him, Dr. Guerrero, what's going on? She said, it's not looking good. There's no blockage nowhere. We don't understand what's going on. We're trying to get her to the Walter Reed Memorial Hospital in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
So one other doctor had said to me, well, she might need a heart transplant and this and that. I said, let me tell you something. When my daughter got her physical examination in Germany, to be deployed to Iraq, she was in perfect health. Whatever happened to my daughter happened over there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
what was their response to that?
Well, yes, the virus attacked her body, and, you know, I think my daughter was one of the first cases. And then, though, she was the second case, because when I got to Germany, I talked to the Lantham family, and they told me this, that their husband had the same thing just about what my daughter had. So everybody in that unit contacted almost the same thing. The lungs filled up with the sand and the chemicals and the... Now, she was a little fortunate because it didn't attack both her lungs. It attacked one lung and her heart. But everybody else, mostly all the other soldiers, both their lungs were attacked. They were full of sand. And so, anyway...
How many other soldiers in her unit were affected by this?
When I got to Walter Reed, they said they had pronounced 5 with imminent death. One passed away. 2 were still in ICU when we left Washington. Another soldier kind of pulled out of it, and one died.
And so what type of treatment has she received since she returned?
Well, none. Today's her first day, and I don't know what's going on because I haven't heard from her since she left this morning. But today's the first time she had any kind of medical treatment.
And how long has she been back?
We both arrived here July 9th, and this is her first time. She's been trying hard to get these appointments.
So tell us what happened between the time when you walked into the room and saw your daughter hooked up to all those machines.
Oh, just the pain there when I seen all those machines. And she was a small girl, and she was all puffy and bloated, and her skin had turned real dark. And when I looked at her, I knew the poison was rising. I just held her hand. I said, you can't touch her. I said, I'm holding her hand. I said, I'm here. But she was out of it. She didn't know he was even there.
But she is back home now.
Yes. Well, from Germany, she was in Walter Reed Bed Medical Center for 5 weeks. Hmm. They just got her up the 7th week to try to get her to do her PT and OT because she was out of it. Her blood pressure kept dropping. She kept getting infections. This is after she came to 3 weeks ago. She wasn't looking too good because she lost so much weight because she didn't eat for all those weeks. She couldn't eat. She had the tube down her throat, and she had the life support on one side, and a whole bunch of other machines on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And she stayed like that even when they medevaced us from Germany to Washington, she stayed like that. And she was heavily, heavily sedated. And that's how she lost some of her hair. The scalp was bald back here. And when I pointed it out to the doctors, they said it was called alopecia.
Mm-hmm.
Alopecia.
Yes.
Hair loss from either, I thought it was from the sand because they didn't wash her hair for like 4 weeks because they didn't want her to catch a cold. So the hair was full of sand, and in the sand was a lot of chemicals. Maybe that's how she lost her hair. I really don't know. Mm.
Have they given you any kind of formal diagnosis to date of what caused your daughter's severe illness?
Yes, they told me, which I don't believe them, that a virus attacked her heart.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I don't think so. And now they see a lot of soldiers that's coming back now are having the same thing. They call it mysterious illness.
Mm-hmm.
She's serving our country. She's a number two, guys. She's serving the United States. She loves the country, but she's my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I went through a lot of changes in 2 months. I'm not right yet. When I got over there, I had to go to the doctor because I got sick.
It's difficult, Ms. Turner, not to compare your daughter's story with the more high-profile story of Jessica Lynch, who was given 3 medals, including a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star for her service.
And I saw that. My daughter and her was on the same floor in both hospitals, the same floor. She was in 57. My daughter was in 58 in Washington. In Germany, my daughter was in room 7. I think she was in room 3.
Your daughter, Vanessa, was not injured by bullets or while in pursuit of the enemy. As Jessica was, there was a car accident she was involved in. Has the Army or the White House made any recognition of the sacrifice that your daughter Vanessa made?
No, the only one that came, well, that really did was Colin Powell. He came to the hospital. He took pictures with her. He shook her hand. And he thanked her for fighting for our country and whatnot.
Is she in line for a Purple Heart or a Bronze Star?
I doubt it. But I did hear something about a Purple Heart, but I heard it one time. That was in Washington. I haven't heard anything else,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I doubt that.
What, she just fell to the ground?
I heard she felt dizzy. She sat on a can, and because one of her soldiers was there, he told me the whole story. He stayed with her from the time it happened till the time we got to Germany, and he told me, she got dizzy. She sat on an old raggedy can that had been bombed up and whatever, you know. She sat on that. And then when she stood up, she felt like somebody, maybe 10 minutes later, she felt like someone was choking her. So they took the can, they took it to wherever they take it, and they tested it for chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had a lot of mosquito bites on her arm. And I was told that they were open wounds, like, because she was scratching them so much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. They said she put some lotion on. That's what did it. So I heard so many stories. I don't believe anything.
What has she told you about her situation?
She said she remembers the mosquito bites. She said she went to the pharmacy to get something for them because they were itching so bad. Evidently, they didn't know that the wounds were open. She had scratched them so bad on both arms all the way up. So I don't know what's going on.
Ms. Turner, we sincerely thank you for sharing this ordeal with Peace Watch and our listeners. Do you have any final thoughts?
I don't want any more, no more or no less. I just want her to get what she deserves, you know what I'm saying? Like, I want her to get her medical. I want her to get help.
Mm-hmm. What were her reasons for going into the Army?
She said she wanted to defend her country. She went to Saudi Arabia, she came back in one piece. She went to North Korea, she came back in one piece. All right, Desert Storm, and came back in one piece. She goes over here and gets all messed up.
Beverly Turner is the mother of Army Sergeant Vanessa Turner, who recently returned from Iraq, suffering from what the Army has diagnosed only as a mysterious disease. At least 4 other soldiers serving in Iraq had similar symptoms. As unrest and killings of U.S. soldiers continue on a daily basis in Iraq, the White House is sometimes quick to point to Afghanistan as an example of a success story. But that's not the case, say some observers, as opium production and crime are soaring to unprecedented levels. The Taliban is making a resurgence and the country is on the edge of chaos. Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles spoke recently with John Sifton, Afghanistan researcher with Human Rights Watch, and Ann Brodsky, author and professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, about the current situation in Afghanistan.
There's a big difference between what's going on in cities and what's going on in rural areas. Kabul City has some relative calm to it, but there are some serious problems nonetheless with the political situation there. A lot of political intimidation of journalists, and a lot of stagnancy, I think, in the political reform supposed to go forward over the last year. And in rural areas, you have a very different situation. In the rural areas, you essentially have the rule of the gun. The former Mujahideen commanders and commanders who fought against the Taliban, who were brought back into power when the United States attacked the Taliban 2 years ago, are now basically in charge of most rural areas. They rule over those areas like criminal warlords, collecting extortion money, kidnapping people and holding them for ransom and stealing whatever they want from local populations.
Ann Brodsky, you also returned recently from Pakistan, and I believe you also spent some time in Afghanistan. Is that right?
Right.
Do you concur with what John is saying?
Absolutely. I have to agree with everything that John is saying. And the question on everyone's lips there is, why has the U.S. brought the warlords and the criminals of the Northern Alliance back to power? And you really do see signs of their hands everywhere, from the reconstruction that is much more beneficial for officials, for warlords, for commanders, for their family members. It's helping some foreign businesses quite a lot. Some foreign NGOs are profiting. But the people themselves are really still suffering quite a great deal. And this is not anything like the liberation and democracy that we're hearing about so hopefully here in the U.S. And as someone said to me, what you're hearing in the U.S. is like seeing the flowers from the horse.
John Sifton, you mentioned the issue of press freedom, and there was recently an incident that caught some attention with two editors of Afghanistan's Aftab newspaper who were arrested and then freed on charges of insulting Islam. They have currently gone into hiding, and the case has prompted a lot of criticism from others, including Human Rights Watch, that say that the Afghan government is not doing enough to protect freedom of speech. Can you give us an update on this case and maybe also explain a little bit about why this case is significant?
Yeah, the Aftab case is a very serious case. It's really a test, in a way, for Karzai as to whether he could uphold the freedom of the press in Kabul City, the only place where it really exists at this point. And frankly, President Karzai failed that test. The articles that were published in Aftab that led to this incident were extremely critical of many of the Mujahideen leaders who are now in power in Kabul. They raised very, very serious questions about the history of Islamic conservatism in Afghanistan over the last 100 years. You know, there's been some debate about whether the critical tone of the article amounted to blasphemy, which in fact is a crime under the Afghanistan constitution. But I think what's very clear is whether it is or it isn't, and we don't think it is. The case was brought with political intentions. This has nothing to do with upholding principles of Islam. It has everything to do with silencing critics of the power grab that's going on in Kabul right now by the former Mujahideen parties.
It sounds like there is still a fairly extremist Islamic element in the country that has come back with the power of the United States and ideologically is not opposed to or in opposition to what the Taliban was. Would you concur with that, John?
They're certainly nowhere near to the extent of, I guess, idiocy, you might say, of mm-hmm. the Taliban regime.
Right.
But there are some things to worry about. Afghanistan requires democracy. It requires, I think, pluralism.
And its people demand it, as far as I can tell from some of the articles I've read.
And the problem right now is that there are a set of actors who don't want that, and they're pushing extremely hard and intimidating their opponents. And worse still, I think, labeling their opponents infidels and, you know, against Islam. these charges, whether they're ever proven or not, they damage people politically and they sideline opponents. That's why we're so concerned about the way that Karzai has handled this. He hasn't stood up for these people.
And speaking of infidels, one group that has been labeled infidels has been the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, which is a group that Anne Brodsky, my other guest, has been very closely working with, has written a book about. Anne, can you talk a little bit about this notion of Islamic law and how, at some level, even if one might say, well, Afghanistan is an Islamic country and it should be run according to an Islamic constitution, what does that mean for women, which was supposedly the pretext of one of the pretexts that the U.S. went to war over?
The important point is that it is not saying anything about the merits of Islam as a private choice and about the religion of the majority of the population of Afghanistan. RAWA members are Muslim to a large extent. Many of them are observant. Others of them are not practicing. What their concern is that over the years in Afghanistan, under the Mujahideen, the jihadis, the civil war from 92 to 96, as well as under the Taliban, the use of religion as a military and a governing tool saw a real corruption of Islam and saw it used as a very dangerous force. And so their concern is that separation of religion and of state will protect religion as well as protecting the people from the misuse of religion.
John Sifton, who is the Afghanistan researcher for Human Rights Watch, at this point, is it the United Nations that can actually step in and do something about what's happening?
What we'd call for at this point is for the United States, the United Kingdom, and any other nation, all other nations that are assisting local commanders at the local level, and there are several, including Iran, Russia, and Pakistan, to stop that assistance immediately. They're getting telephones, weapons, vehicles, and cash assistance, and also just simple political support.
John, you were a participant in a congressional hearing that took place in June on Afghanistan, which didn't receive much press. And one of the things that you were bringing up these very issues of how security in Afghanistan is incredibly dire right now, and that there are a lot of warring factions that are fighting one another and civilians are being put at risk. What was the response that you received, particularly from Congressman Dana Rohrabacher?
There was an extremely disappointing response on behalf of the Congress that showed up to that hearing. I think the conventional wisdom is that the allies that the United States had in fighting the Taliban are good people. The reality is that that's just not true. Many of the people who fought alongside the United States against the Taliban are extremely dangerous criminal military commanders who have undisciplined, unprofessional troops.
Anne Brodsky, what did you find out about the role of women in the government in Afghanistan? There are elections expected next year, and certainly we hope that they will happen. And is RAWA, one of the prime political women's organizations on the forefront of fighting for women's rights, are they involved at all in the drafting of a new constitution?
The edicts that the Taliban did in a legislated form that controlled women's actions and kept them in the home and out of work, In effect, the actions of the jihadi and the criminal warlords really kept women out of work, out of school, off the streets because of the danger of the situation, and women are feeling that same danger today. You know, we heard reports that women had immediately taken off their burqas and were dancing in the streets. Problem is that women are still wearing them. We saw no women in Jalalabad who weren't wearing burqas. We saw maybe 30% of women at maximum in Kabul who weren't wearing burqas. And when you asked why, they would say because of the danger. They needed to keep themselves protected. They needed to protect their identities. They needed to be able to keep from being kidnapped and raped and forced to marry from the streets, as happened before. One of the large problems for Afghanistan is going to be, even if elections take place, if there's not the disarmament of these warlords of their soldiers, then this is not going to be a free and fair election. And we may something like Liberia in the future, where Charles Taylor was elected, but he was elected with the guns of his supporters during those elections.
Just speaking of Congress, I just want to briefly talk a little bit about two things with you, John. One, the International Security Assistance Force. What is the status of that, which is in Kabul, that a lot of aid agencies have called for to expand to the rest of the country, and the U.S. has stood in the way of it? And also, what about aid from the United States military and financial aid?
Yeah, right now, NATO is taking over the lead of ISAF in the future. And there is some hope that there may be an expansion. There's going to be an assessment mission that will go forward. And there's some hopes there that that will happen. The United States is at this point willing to allow an expansion, and it's possible that there will be one. It is vital that that goes forward.
Wouldn't that make it a less accountable organization? Right now, it is representative of the United Nations, of very, very, very multilateral organization. NATO is represented only by a few countries, all of them Western countries, European, and the United States.
Let me just explain. It will continue to be a United Nations force. It's just the command of it would be under NATO. The way it's worked so far is that it's been always an international force. It's just that somebody, some nation or some organization has to be officially sort of in charge of the whole thing. Right now, that country is Germany and the Netherlands together. Germany at the very top.
And then going on to the issue of aid, Congress has made a commitment to rebuilding Afghanistan through what's called the Afghanistan Freedom Support Act, which allocated $3.3 billion in economic and military assistance.
That's absolutely true. Problem one is that the money is not enough. Even if you take the money that it has been supplied, simply put, the reconstruction projects that are required for Afghanistan are not going forward right now. There have been some ministries which are being reformed. The Interior Ministry, the Finance Ministry are both, they're undergoing reform, which is in a positive direction. But the truth is the majority of the transitional government is in extremely bad shape. But really the number one reason, again, is insecurity. The United States continuing to work with local warlords who are not really on board the central government's plan, who are really just interested in having their fiefdoms and their criminal activities. These people are standing in the way right now.
I don't know if you had the chance to interact with a lot of Afghans, and particularly women, but even men. What is the sense right now toward the United States? The U.S. is currently occupying Iraq, as well as the feelings, the sentiment within Iraq toward the United States are souring. There are a lot of Iraqis who are saying, yes, okay, thank you for taking out Saddam Hussein, and now we want you to leave. Is there any similar feeling in Afghanistan, or are people still feeling like the United States is sort of the good guy who has come out and helped them?
Well, that's a very good question, because what gets done in the name of the United States gets done in the name of all of us as citizens of this country or residents of this country. And unfortunately, what I was sensing was a real sort of turning of the feeling towards the United States, with especially this question of what is the U.S. thinking with giving power and continuing to work with these criminals and these warlords. Everyone says that the U.S. is pulling the strings, that Karzai's word isn't good outside of his ministry, that he's really the mayor of Kabul. If you ask them who's in charge, they'll say Khalilzad.
Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan.
Right. And so as things are not going the way they should be, as people on the ground are not seeing the aid money coming to their assistance at all, as they're seeing warlords continuing to control and in some cases sort of consolidating their power now in the government, they really are asking, what is the U.S. trying to do to us here? The other thing that's really important is that what we're hearing here and what it looks like concretely on the ground is so very different, and it's an example of that saying of seeing the flowers from the horse. For example, yes, some girls' schools have been rebuilt, but in many places they've been taken over for boys' schools in places like Herat, which is controlled by a fundamentalist warlord. In other places, the construction's been incomplete. So there's a girls' school, but there's no walls that have been built around the perimeter, and this is just not appropriate for families there. They won't send their girls to be kind of watched as they go into school. And so it's there, but it's not complete. In the face of this, what people are saying is that the education minister is building his third palatial house in Kabul. And so there's a real feeling that there must be money for some people. It's just not reaching the people who really need it, the citizens.
What would you recommend for people here in the United States to do at this point, who are hearing what the two of you are saying and realizing that Afghanistan is really a forgotten country and has fallen under the radar? Is there anything that we can do?
It's really important that we voice our opinions about this, that we are vocal, that just because mainstream media and the Bush administration want to paint this as a done deal and as a liberated country, we know what the facts are. We need to continue to get the facts. There's alternative news sources such as your show. need to contact senators and congresspeople to say that this is important, that we want to make sure that this country is moving forward in a way that we had promised. And it's both in the interest of Afghanistan and, frankly, in our self-interest. The other thing that people said was, this is a recipe for another September 11th. Didn't the U.S. learn its lesson the first time?
Thank you very much, Anne Brodsky. John Sifton, Human Rights Watch, is also going to be putting out a report very soon on Afghanistan. Your closing comments on the situation there, what people should be paying attention to and vigilant about, and is there anything people can do?
As Anne said, there's a real need to challenge the conventional wisdom and to ask questions about what exactly is going on. I mean, the question that should be in everybody's mind these days is America safer than it was on the morning of September 11th, 2001? Afghanistan was the nest from which September 11th sprang. And the reason it was because it was so unstable. The American policy has to be questioned by most Americans at this point. We don't want it to become, once again, a dangerous rogue nation which can serve as a place where terrorists can set up training camps and basically do what they will.
John Sifton is an Afghanistan researcher with Human Rights Watch, and Anne Brodsky is an author and professor of psychology at the University of Maryland. They were interviewed by Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.